Hey, everybody. A lot of new people here tonight. We On Tap runs every month, of course, and we're usually here. But for everybody who's not kind of familiar with how this works, pretty informal. We're going to ask a couple questions to get things going, and then we're going to turn it over to you to ask questions. Just a quick reminder, sometimes we have politicians up on the stage. We don't tonight. So these things can get kind of lively, so just save maybe some of the rancor that we normally have for politicians. Neither of these guys are elected officials, and they're not in charge of policy the same way some of the representatives and senators we've had up here. So I'm going to turn it over to Logan. We'll get going here.
Yeah, and one of the things that Joe and I talked about when we first started playing this event was that we really didn't want this to become a debate about whether or not global warming was real or not, or whether or not it was man-caused. We really, and you know, you can think about it like this. Regardless of whether you believe in the science, the climate forecast that I've seen, Joe and I, you know, we've spent some time at the National Weather Center and seen the PowerPoints from the scientists there, and it doesn't paint a very pretty picture. All the forecasts call for a hotter, drier next 50 years for Oklahoma. And state agencies, farmers, ranchers, nonprofit groups, insurance companies, university researchers are all preparing based on some of these forecasts. And so that's really where we want to start tonight. And be sure whenever we turn it over to you guys, the audience, to try and make your questions brief. We want to rebroadcast this. And if you talk too long, your question may get cut and you won't hear yourself on the radio, and that would be unfortunate. So I want to introduce our panel tonight. We're pleased to have with us two people who are making a real difference literally on the ground in getting the state ready for a changing climate and the more extreme weather that comes with us. Clay Pope is here. He's the director of the Oklahoma Association of Conservation Districts. Thanks for coming, Clay. Why don't you tell us first a little bit about yourself and what your association does?
I'm Clay Pope, executive director of OACD, the Oklahoma Association of Conservation Districts. Our group represents the 87 conservation districts, the 87 state conservation districts and the two tribal conservation districts that are spread all over Oklahoma. Don't want to go over a whole lot of ground that some of you may be familiar with. Real quick, how many folks in here are familiar with conservation districts? Well, you two ought to be. A handful of folks are. Conservation districts grew out of the Dust Bowl. You think back to the 1930s, what was happening in the southern plains of the United States. We were facing basically desertification. I mean, we were having a situation where the southern plains of the United States, because of climate conditions combined with the way that we were treating the land, we really were seeing a catastrophe unseen in the history of the United States and really in the history of modern man. Worst man-made environmental catastrophe in modern times. The decision was made in Washington, D.C. You know, clearly we wanted to keep the land in production. There was some debate about that, actually, but the decision was made. We want to make sure that we keep the land in production. We don't want to see part of our country go from prairie to prairie in less than one generation. The decision was made that instead of coming out with the iron fist of regulation, we were going to come out with the open hand of friendship. And we were going to set up a program through the Soil Conservation Service, now the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS. You'll probably hear me throw that out every once in a while as an acronym, to work with agriculture producers and landowners to through financial assistance in the form of cost share money, splitting the cost with them to do different practices on the land, and technical assistance to try to address the problems that were happening out in the countryside, and not just with wind erosion, too. A lot of folks don't realize Lincoln County, Oklahoma, was actually the most highly eroded county in the United States in the 1930s, and that wasn't from wind erosion. That was clearly water erosion. So we had several natural resource problems that we were dealing with in the United States that focused on starting with soil erosion. And to try to run those programs in, they said to make them work, and it's going to be a voluntary system. We're not going to force anybody to do anything. Free technical assistance, cost share, you've got to have buy-in. And a lot of times what looks good on paper doesn't always work that well on the land. And, of course, we all know the situation. You go out and you're talking to folks locally. You know, say, hey, I'm from the state of Oklahoma. We're here to help you. Or, heaven forbid, I'm from Washington, D.C., and we're here to help you. It's completely different than having someone that's a local say, hey, look, we have an issue that we've got to deal with, and we have to try to solve it. It's instead of having somebody from the state or federal government saying, you got a problem, and you got to take care of it. It's saying, hey, we all have to work together and find a solution for this common problem we've all got to deal with. So local conservation districts are formed. The landowners formed them themselves. There was model legislation actually came out from the Roosevelt administration as part of the New Deal. Landowners formed the districts. That's why I got 87 districts, 77 counties. So anyway, that's who I represent. They set the priorities for the Farm Bill programs. They also help administer state conservation programs. Non-point source pollution is one of the big issues we deal with, as well as climate change, wildlife habitat, a lot of other stuff. I also farm and ranch at a little town called Loyal. My wife's over here telling me to shut up. I apologize. They said that you said your questions are going to be long. long, my answer is going to be longer, so don't worry about it.
Thank you, Clay.
I farm and ranch a little town called Loyal. My father and brother and I, we've got about 4,000 acres. We farm wheat and cattle, but I also work for the conservation districts. And in all fairness, I am a recovering politician, so you don't get mad at him, get mad at me if y'all want to be rankers about something, because like those other guys, that I used to do that for a living so I can take some of it. So that's who I am, and I'll shut up and let him talk.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. And also joining us, Dr. David Engel. He's a researcher, professor, also director of the Oklahoma Water Resources Center at OSU. What's your focus now, and tell us a little bit about the OSU Water Center.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Yeah, so I'm director of the Water Resources Center, and it is within the Division of Agricultural Sciences and Natural Resources at OSU. It is funded by two agencies that some of you may have never heard of before. One is the Oklahoma Agricultural Experiment Station. How many have heard of the Oklahoma Ag Experiment Station? All right. How about Oklahoma Cooperative Extension Service? All right, most of you. All right. So those two agencies fund the Water Resources Center, and the idea there is to conduct research, uncover the most knowledge possible about our water resources, pass that on to the Cooperative Extension Service, which passes it on to stakeholders, citizens of the state of Oklahoma. Lately, we have been fortunate enough to landed a couple of large grants, research and extension grants. One of those is focused on climate change, climate variability, and beef cattle production off of forages. And we can talk more about that later.
Great. All right. Dr. Engel, I get right to the questions here, and I'll kind of start with you. Earlier today, I was looking at some of the research that you've been involved in, and it's a huge, huge range, you know, everything from red cedar trees, water use, all the way to how controlled burning affects butterfly habitats in rangeland.
I was afraid you'd bring that up.
A lot of what you do revolves around the health of rangelands and the habitats of the species that live there. If you had to kind of give a state of Oklahoma's rangeland speech, what would be the highlights this year?
Well, I think you could say you couldn't separate this year from really 10 or 20 years ago, and that is it's in a declining state, primarily because of eastern red cedar. That's a simple answer.
I see. Very good. And, Clay, a couple years ago, you made an interesting comment in a story I was reading about there was this big dust storm in Kay County, and it caused a lot of car accidents. And you had said, and I want to quote you here on this, that all civilization rests on about an inch of topsoil. That's where all our food and fiber comes from. So when it's gone, it's gone. So I'm curious, 2 years later, and with the state still suffering through drought, are we losing that topsoil? What's the situation with that now?
Well, if you were in Oklahoma Sunday night, you know the answer to that question. We've got some serious problems. I mean, it's nowhere near, and I mentioned the Dust Bowl earlier. You know, we're not reliving the 1930s. I mean, let's face it. We're not seeing dust storms that are covered. They're starting in Boise City, Oklahoma, and covering ships in the Atlantic Ocean 300 miles out to sea with dust. You know, you're not seeing Washington, D.C. and New York City being as dark as midnight at 3 o'clock in the afternoon from dust storms that started at Lubbock, Texas. That's just not happening. But that being said, we do have some problems. In fact, we put out some information earlier in the week asking producers to think a little bit and see what their options are before they plow. I'm concerned. You look at what happened. Mentioned Lubbock, Texas, Amarillo, Denver. There was some real problems yesterday. And a lot of it's cotton ground that's been worked up in anticipation of planting this spring, dry land ground that has been worked to the point that there's not a lot of subsoil moisture. And if you get that residue off of the top, sandy ground's going to blow. I mean, there's just no way around it. And that's a concern. A lot of wheat this year is going to be zeroed out because of the late freeze, the drought conditions before it. You're going to have insurance adjusters going out. It will be a crop failure. And even the wheat that's not a crop failure, you're cutting 10, 18 bushel wheat, it ain't going to take you long to cut it. And like most other producers, too, I'm going to be thinking the same thing. I'm maybe plant Sudan or Milo. Want to go in and get that ground ready. Of course, we no-till, so we farm a little different. But that's the thing, is asking producers to look, you know, is there some ways that you, instead of going out and working that ground up, or if you are going to work it up, make sure you keep as much residue as possible on the soil. Maybe look at some things like no-till and minimum till, because, yeah, it's a concern, and it's something that, you know, everybody thinks about dirt. Somebody asked me the other day, because we talk a lot about soil health, and I'll probably get off on that kick here in a little bit at some point, but you know, they say, why do you give a damn about dirt? And I say, because dirt determines destiny. It really does. And a lot of what we're talking about, whether it's water, whether it's wildlife, whether it's climate, you know, carbon, the carbon cycle and climate change, it's all tied to the soil.
And both of you interact with farmers and ranchers on a pretty regular basis. Is that right? How responsive are they to some of these ideas? It was shocking to me when Joe and I did a story a few weeks ago at the Grazing Lands Research Lab that no-till wasn't more standard. How receptive are farmers and ranchers to these kinds of ideas when you talk to them?
Ask me.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
Well, Logan, I think they are receptive. You know what's taken everybody off guard, though, to get back to Clay's point about the bare ground that's out there, is that we really were spoiled by 30 years or so of above-average precipitation. And we're coming to grips with that. I think most people are realizing that we're not in that wet period. And just you've seen from the climatologists at OU that we can probably expect maybe a comparably long period of time with below average precipitation. So the way we did things under that high precipitation can't be applied to low precipitation. And so I think people, they recognize that, but actually, you know, applying that is a whole other story. And so, you know, the conservation tillage that Clay's practicing, it's fairly new kind of concept to the state, and it doesn't come without some downsides. And so working through those downsides takes some time and an adjustment of mindset and practices, equipment, and it's an investment sort of thing. And we have a lot of those kinds of investments that we're probably a little behind on. And so another example I like is the red cedar thing. The red cedar thing is just, it's because we failed to invest in the right kind of land management. And one day we woke up and we had a red cedar infestation. We actually could see that here 40 years ago.
What's the solution to that? Do you have any idea of how we can rid ourselves of this menace?
Well, and kind of build on what he said, and it's, well, hey, I mean, let's face it, you know, if you have enough money, you can do anything. But when you're losing the equivalent of, what is it, 700 acres a day to the eastern red cedar is what we lose, it's a cost. It's a real hard cost. And kind of talking what we said about conversion to conservation tillage, I'll be honest with you, the reason why my family converted to no-till, our equipment was wore out. We were going to have to make an investment. It was going to cost us $30,000 just in parts, with us doing our labor just to fix our disc. Now, you know, it cost us around $200,000 to buy the equipment, and we're not big farmers by any stretch of the imagination. There's a cost involved with it. You've seen no-till adopted in other parts of the country earlier than it is in Oklahoma because of the crop. I mean, corn and soybeans are a lot higher value than winter wheat. The other thing, if you're going to no-till, you've got to rotate. And one of the challenges you have is that so much of what, you know, as we rotate, that also means there's going to be some winters where your ground's going to be fallow. Well, that means you're not going to have calves out there on winter wheat, because most of us do double crop. You know, we talk about double crop. We double crop because we got dual-purpose wheat. We got wheat. We run calves on it, or cow-calf pairs. In the wintertime, we pull them off in March. Wheat goes ahead, get wheat heads out. We harvest it. We got two crops off of one field. But in the summertime, we're in the teeth of the summer. It's hot. It's dry. That's one of the challenges we have. I mentioned soil health. We're trying to do things with cover crops, trying to do more things to make sure we've got something green and growing on the land all year round, trying to do some biomimicry. Challenge we have in Oklahoma, unlike Iowa, Indiana, Ohio, even Nebraska, and a lot of Kansas, is the heat, the rain patterns that we're fighting a little bit as far as what you can rotate with and working that out. We don't have all those answers yet. And the other thing is the cost. Again, wheat's not as worth as much as corn and soybeans. So you've got that. You've got cultural practices. I don't mind having people talking funny about me at the coffee shop. Some guys do. I mean, that's just, and you know, and my dad's 84 years old today. And dad's still farming, and dad's all in on no-till. He believes in what we're doing. He's 100% sold on it. But to this day, he'll drive past fields whenever we got the wheat cut, and neighbors got the ground all worked up, and ours, we've hit it with herbicides. What you talk about downside, you know, using chemicals to control weeds, and that's not always popular with a lot of folks. Now, you hope with cover crops, you can cut into some of that, and maybe even eliminate that. But that's one of the hurdles you got to jump over. But he'll sit there and he'll look at it and he'll say, man, that just doesn't look as good. You know, that plowed ground looks so much better because that's what we were growing up to do. Red cedar's the same way. There's cost. Fire is the best way to control red cedar. You know, the prairies burned on their own. But when you have houses, livestock, towns, people get a little bit antsy about having fire all the time. So it's just challenges, and it's trying to figure out how you balance the economic reality with what you've got to do and recognizing that there are things you can do different, and in the long run, you'll actually benefit from it. But trying to answer some of those questions and work those challenges out is what we're tasked with.
Joe is somewhere with the mobile mic right here. So, yeah, hands up if you want to ask a question. We will get around to you.
Hello, I'm Josh. I'm from UConn. I'm actually a transplant from Connecticut. So let me say the positive thing. Now, the negative thing is I work in the oil field. The thing about the oil field is I get the opportunity to travel the whole state of Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, Louisiana, and so forth. And one thing that I've noticed about Oklahoma was the ignorance about what's actually happened in the oil field. About 20% of Oklahomans are actually employed through the energy economy. Mean it be actually drillers, frac crew, drilling, production, lease, drill pipe, chemicals, wherever it is, it's a known fact. And I've been noticing that the conversations I've had with a lot of these guys have been that they're not really understanding the process of the fracking industry. I understand people are talking about the fracking process, but nobody is talking about the use of water. I've been in the oil field since 2007, and I've noticed that a lot of the farmers, they say, hey, come on in, take the fresh water that we have on my land. I'll, you know, charge you so much to take so many gallons and so forth. And since 2007, I've noticed that we've gone from one farmer to another farmer to another farmer because that first farmer we went to has no more water. The second farmer we went to has no more water. And the ignorance I'm talking about is that a lot of people are not talking about how much water is put into the ground. And even if the water comes back, you can hear the argument from the oil energy side saying, well, the ground will naturally filter out the chemicals, and that's why they use gum base and cedar mulch and so forth. And my question to you is when is, I know we don't have a politician, you know, except you, but when is someone going to actually talk about the water usage for that? Because you're not talking about, everybody's talking about water for farmland and the lack of, and nobody's really talking about the water that's going into the ground and what's trying to come back up.
Well, and there are some discussions going out there. I think whether it's not, you know, how vocal those discussions are being in the general public, I think as the drought goes on, you're going to hear a whole lot more discussions about it. Because I can tell you from coffee shop talk, it's not as attractive selling water. I mean, the dollar signs look pretty good, but I can tell you, I guarantee there's a lot of producers right now, it's not as attractive selling water as it was 2-3 years ago. It's just not. I mean, and that's what we actually, and full disclosure, we sold some water too. They were drilling around home and we sold some water. Had a little problem with them because when they were supposed to turn the pump off, they didn't turn it off. That's another story, but we got that straightened out too. But I think there's some more discussions going on about that. And I think the issue of reuse is something that we, you know, one of the things that another thing the legislature has done that hasn't gotten a lot of play and really hasn't gone all that far. There was a bill a couple of years ago to look at desalinization of some of the salt water. Of course, now the problem you're going to do is what do you do with that brine that's thicker than that? And that's a challenge. There is an argument to be made. There's a heck of a lot of salt water out there, and as things get desperate, that you can do that, but it's kind of like some other things too. Understand what you're going to do with the end product and how you're going and what you're going to deal with it. So I mean, there's been some talk about how you strike that balance, but it's a delicate line to walk, I'll guarantee you. But there's a lot of folks about selling water issue that has become a hotter topic.
Got another question over here. Just
yeah, I'm Glenn Robertson from Norman, and we've got people meeting tonight about our water problems down there. So, but my question, and maybe it's an observation, I was at a conference last week with a fellow who was head of the Altus Irrigation District, and he gave an excellent presentation on all the problems they're having down there. But he also kept saying, when things come back to normal, when things come back to normal. And I'm guessing that is it a fact that one of the greatest problems you have is battling the myth that droughts are just rude interruptions from good times?
Is there a normal? And are we ever going to see it again?
Well, yeah, you know, so that's a really good point, because in reality, in Oklahoma, in fact, the entire Great Plains, normality is this huge variation. So, you know, we can say our normal or our climate is marked by dry and wet periods. And, in fact, extended wet periods followed by extended dry periods. So that's normal. That's normal. The problem we have is just kind of like the Red Cedar problem again, is humans, we just have a hard time encompassing large expanses of time or space. And so it just, you know, Clay said it, you know, we had a little bit, especially the eastern two-thirds of the state last year, we had a bump in precipitation. You look at 2013 and it was a little wetter than normal, maybe, especially in the summer, late summer. And so, we're back to normal again. The truth of the matter is, you go back and look at those, the climatologists show this all the time. You look at just the recorded record since the late 1800s in the state. Every one of those extended drought periods, like the 50s and the 30s, also had wet years embedded in them. And that's normal, is that we shooting this drought here, we can, if it goes on for a couple of decades, we're going to have some more wet years. And that's normal as well.
You know, that's the ironic thing about it. You know, we talk about soil erosion. One of the things that we do in the conservation districts, we have over 2,100 upstream flood control structures in Oklahoma, more than any other state in the union. Of course, now kind of segue on that. It's kind of ironic when you say things are back to normal when you live in a state that doesn't have a single natural lake in it. And your water all supplied by things that we did to terraform the countryside. But the reason why those flood control dams are there, the reason why USDA does that, and the reason why the conservation districts, Conservation Commission and the NRCS does that, is because the second worst flood in Oklahoma history happened in 1938, the Hammond flood, and that's what started the whole movement to do upstream flood control structures. Worst flood in Oklahoma history was 2007, when we had that inland hurricane that reformed over Oklahoma, which at that time was at the tail end of what was the driest 18-month period we'd seen in the history of the state of Oklahoma. So yeah, that's that. And if you look at what the people who are a lot smarter than me say are in the crystal ball, we've always had droughts, we've always had floods. I mean, that's what the record is. It's just what was the 100-year flood is going to become the normal spring rain, and what, you know, was the drought of record becomes something that happens every few years. And that's what the concern is that because we've always had crazy weather. Like I said, again, we just shot it full of steroids. And how do you deal with that?
You're listening to a live recording of State Impact's public forum on how climate change is affecting Oklahoma. The live discussion event featured two panelists, Clay Pope, Executive Director of the Oklahoma Association of Conservation Districts, and Dr. David Engel, Director of Oklahoma State University's Water Resources Center. We return now to more questions from the audience.
Got a question up here on the second level here.
Hi, I'm Michelle Kingdom, and I'm an educator in Edmond, Oklahoma. I raise my kids on a wheat and cattle farm outside of Enid. And I think we need to talk about, when you're talking about the no-till and using the poisons and the chemicals, like Banville 2,4-D, you know them, broadleaf weed killers, and the pesticides for the green bugs. The water that the little water that we do have, we're polluting it terribly. We've lost I don't know how many songbirds over the last 30 and 40 years due to pesticides. You know, that a lot of that stuff is put on, of course, anhydrous, but also granular stuff. Birds think that that is food for them, and they will eat those granules, and their embryos of their eggs will be deformed. And even Roundup is affecting the fertility in young girls. And working with middle school kids and telling them that the oil industry is poisoning their earth, you know, we have to look at everybody. Everybody has a responsibility in that. Clay, how do you handle your broadleaf weeds and your green bugs on your soil?
Well, one of the things I'd say, you talk about poisoned water. I would point out, and I agree with you, and that's when you got to be careful about herbicide use. I would say, though, that in all honesty, one of the most effective tools that we've got in our arsenal in reducing non-point source pollution in Oklahoma is conversion to no-till. You do have the trade-off challenge of herbicides, but if you compare that to runoff from a conventional till field, because the number one water quality problem that we've got in the state of Oklahoma is turbidity, just plain old-fashioned dirt. And 90% of the phosphorus and the nitrogen and the bacteria that we get in our water is tied to that soil. So if you can hold that soil particle in place, you're going to address a lot of that water. You're going to address a lot of your water quality concerns. Now, that being said, you're right. And that's one of the flip sides of it, you know, and that's what you can have the debate all night long about conventional till versus no-till. And I could say, well, you know, you look at the Fertile Crescent, that's in Iraq where boys and girls were fighting during the war over there. And I don't know about you, but them shots on TV didn't look too fertile. Well, the reason why it didn't was because of cultivation, you know, the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. Heck, Sahara Desert used to be a savanna, and human practice turned it into a desert. And we were doing the same thing in the 30s. But that being said, that doesn't excuse the other challenges. I think one of the things that we've actually kind of done backwards on no-till, and we've been talking a lot about this, I've mentioned soil health, is we probably messed up a little bit. We probably should have been pushing cover crops before we started talking no-till. Of course, we were focusing on erosion. But the idea of cover crops and trying to use other plants to do the biomimicry to try to do things, if you can find out how your rotations can work, like can use other plants that have a canopy that can choke out some of those plants and then have the winter kill that can help control some of that, actually you can reduce your herb. Now, I have not seen this, but if Greg Scott, who's a retired state soil scientist from NRCS, would hear, he'd tell you right now there's guys in southwest Oklahoma that maybe spray every other year or maybe don't even spray at all. And the reason is because they're using the cover crops to control their weeds. Now, I can't say I've done that, and I can't say I've seen that, but I have read about it. And that's one of the things I think that's our challenge, is continuing to improve what we do, because we know we can do better. And what we're doing now, 10 years ago, talking about soil health, this whole thing about the idea of going back to the fertilizer situation, if you can increase your organic matter in your soil 1%, you can increase it by 1%. Now, these are national numbers. These are not Oklahoma-specific. This is national. You can increase your organic matter by 1% in your soil. You can free up over $700 worth of additional nutrients for growing crops per acre. And that's by the inclusion of legumes. That's by including plants that mine other nutrients out of the soil, make them more readily available for growing crops, by having a healthy microbial community. Because 60% of the fertilizer you put in the ground, if you don't have a healthy microbial community, you're just wasting. The plants can't take it up, because there's a symbiotic relationship between the root system of plants and the bugs and the bacteria and the fungus that evolved over millennia. And a lot of this stuff we didn't even know existed 10 years ago. So I think the challenge is how we continue to improve what we're doing. Is what we're doing perfect? No. Perfect should never be the enemy of good, and we just got to keep learning and doing better. Just like the guys in the 30s that were flipping that ground and getting it bare, they weren't evil. They just doing what they knew to do. And I think as we understand and know things, that's the kicker, is making sure that we help people adopt it, that they've got the tools to help them adopt it, and that we, as an educator, you know this, disseminate that information out to folks and make sure they've got the knowledge that they need. Unfortunately, that takes money. And that's one of the things we're all swimming upstream with, dealing with natural resources.
Or could you address any of the what she was saying about fertilizers, herbicides on the bird species? Is that something that you've looked at all? Or
I haven't. I think she's maybe talking about some of the broadcast biocides, pelleted biocides, and of course they're labeled such that you shouldn't be applying them that way to endanger any wildlife species. So beyond that, you know, there are restrictions to the use of any pesticide, including herbicides. And those are really for human safety as well as wildlife and the environment in general if they're followed. But, you know, what's really, Aldo Leopold said many, many years ago, he's kind of the father of conservation, father of conservation wildlife biology. He said that agricultural science, you know, it's really based on the fact that you're always trying to stay up with the next pest species. And so, you know, there's always something new. So Roundup is a common herbicide used on no-till, and now we have Roundup-resistant weeds. So what do you do with those? So, again, Leopold said it right. We're always just one step behind trying to catch up to the next problem. And at the same time, so if we get this higher level of climate variability and extremes in temperature and precipitation event intensity, that further complicates intensive use of agricultural chemicals inputs. And so we're looking at these things like cover crops, different approaches to help us really adapt to rapid change. And this is nationwide, globally. It's not just Oklahoma.
Question here.
Hello, I'm Sean Doyle, and I'm down in Midwest City, but I forecast at Tinker Air Force Base. And one thing I've been noticing over the last few years is I've been doing a kind of on-the-side climatology project and trying to relate the El Niño-La Niña cycle to tornadoes. Well, in the process, I realized that the extremes between one and the other have been shifting more and more drastically over the years. And my fear is that we're going to be having stronger ridging over the oceans, bringing higher pressure, but then it's going to be like a steeper slide for all these low-pressure systems into Oklahoma. So you're going to have these stronger lows coming through with stronger winds, more precip, and then dry, windy weeks and weeks on end afterwards. So you're going to have 3, 4, 5 more inches and then nothing for months. How's the awareness filtering down to any sort of farmers you've been working with? Because it's going to be a lot of runoff and a lot of soil erosion off of that.
Well, and I think that's one of the things, sitting here listening to the questions and the answers, one of the things, at least for what we do, now this is agriculture specific, but I think it's also got a lesson for the communities too. One of the things that I find so exciting about some of this stuff that we're talking about, going back to the question on the herbicides, is that a lot of the same practices that we're looking at to try to reduce the amount of herbicides are also the same practices that we're trying to do to reduce the amount of soil erosion. And those are also some of the things we're trying to do to reduce the amount of runoff. And those are some of the things we're trying to do to reduce fuel use. And those are some of the things, you know, one of the things that I mentioned, that one of the best tools we got for water quality is conversion to no-till. Oklahoma, Tudor Horn, one of the things, and everybody talks about bad stuff, one of the things we are pretty proud of in Oklahoma, last year we were number 2 among all the states in the union in reduction of nutrients from our surface water. Now that sounds pretty good, but the year before that, we were number 1. And the way that we've been able to do that in Oklahoma is by working with agriculture producers and other folks to do things like convert from conventional till to no-till, take highly erodible land out of production, put it back to grass, do better pasture management, look at cover crops, restore riparian areas along stream. Okay. I mentioned that if you can increase your organic matter, you can increase, you know, it potentially could increase the fertility of your soils, hopefully increase your yields. We hit a wheat yield, or wheat hit a yield ceiling about 30 years ago in Oklahoma. Nebraska, University of Nebraska came out study in November saying we may hit a plateau with all grains and oil seeds cross world. Okay, how are we going to increase production to feed 9 billion people? Well, I mentioned increasing organic matter. Okay, how do you increase organic matter? By getting guys to convert to no-till, taking highly erodible land out of production, putting it back to grass, doing better pasture management, putting in riparian areas, incorporating cover crops. Okay, we want to improve wildlife habitat. What are some of the things on working land that you want to do that? Better pasture management, taking highly erodible land out of production, putting it back to grass, conversion to no-till, using cover crops. What do you want to do if you want to sequester carbon? Which, you want to increase organic matter? 60% of it's organic carbon, because what you're doing is photosynthesis, pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere, putting it back into the ground. Plants release oxygen. That's restored in the form of organic matter. It's what fuels the entire planet. Well, how do you do that? Those same practices I talked about. And if you increase your organic matter by 1%, it triples your soil's water-holding capacity, equivalent to 3-inch rain in Oklahoma. And if you're going to get rain, you're going to hold on to more moisture. That means there's more moisture in the soil profile, which should get your water cycle a little bit more in whack, which also are more in line and more on track, and you can potentially increase your stream flow, which helps water for community downstream. Other things we can do, going back to the extremes of weather, I mentioned Oklahoma doesn't have a single natural lake in it. Well, the reason why we don't is because leaders like Bob Kerr and Mike Monroney, they built lakes because they knew we needed water. That's why we have flood control dams. Those are some of the things that we can do is to learn the lessons of the past, to redo and expand and build on the system networks that we have. So when we have rain, we can capture it. We can reduce flash floods, which reduces runoff, and get our system hardened to that those realities that are in the future.
Joe, you have more questions back there?
Yeah, way back here, we got a question. Here we go.
To get back to climate change, we know that climate change is already built into our system. In fact, the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere right now is not fully implemented in the temperature rise of the global climate change. So we know we're going to get hotter, and we know we're going to get drier. And so what can we... We might have to be more worried about adapting rather than preventing climate change. So what can we do in Oklahoma to adapt and get ready for the possibilities that things are going to get a lot worse? Like in California right now, they have a very bad drought, and they're not going to be able to provide the broccoli that we're all used to eating because we don't produce broccoli in Oklahoma. So what can we do to adapt and to change and to start getting ready for the times that are coming?
What about urban landscapes? Yeah, well, that's a good question.
It's a big
good
one,
question.
Yeah.
So partially to answer that question and also to address the previous question, so Clay answered about agricultural lands in rural areas. I think it's equally important for us to think about climate change, climate variability, extremes, and weather events in urban landscapes. So, and I live in an urban landscape, so I'm pointing a finger at myself as well. If you go to Oklahoma State University and Google LID or low impact development. That's Dr. Jason Vogel. He has a program that really is aimed to helping urban residents to soften their landscape. So we have what he calls hardscapes, right? So our roofs, our driveways, our roads, all of those shed water in these extreme precipitation events. Shed water at a much accelerated rate compared to agricultural land. And so in one sense, in this water quality issue, sedimentation in our reservoirs is largely due to this accelerated runoff from urban landscapes. And Oklahoma City is one of the real hot spots for that in the state of Oklahoma, maybe the hot spot for this sedimentation turbidity in the water in reservoirs. So there's a number of things that we can do, just simple things that you and I can do as homeowners to capture some of that water, to slow it down so it doesn't accelerate off of your residential home site. So...
And ditto. I mean, incorporating rain barrels, doing the xeriscaping, doing permeable parking lots, doing things. You know, my father-in-law, my wife grew up here in Oklahoma City, and I still shake my head. He wants that golf course lawn. And, heck, I got goats because I don't want to mow the dang stuff in my front yard. But really and truly, it's just a different mindset. But that's a challenge, is making sure that all of us, whether you live in rural Oklahoma or you're living in urban Oklahoma, are managing our resources properly, making sure that we are being the best stewards that we can be of every drop of water. That in adaptation, are we doing things? I mentioned the, you know, about capturing water for runoff. Say we got those 2,100 upstream flood control dams. A lot of them could be made into reservoirs. I know building dams is not something with a lot of folks is all that popular, but if we're going to have heavy rain events, we need to capture those drops and use them correctly. Irrigation in Oklahoma, irrigated agriculture, working with guys to convert to drip irrigation, or if there's any, you know, if they're using flood, at least get to sprinklers. Do things. You can get to the point where you can be around 90% efficient with your irrigation water. We need to get to that point where we're doing everything that we can. All of us together, because, you know, going back to the water quality is the best example. We all live in a watershed. You know, and if you get into this thing about pointing the finger at everybody saying it's your fault, that's all you do is sit and argue. It's when you actually sit down and figure out a plan and implement it, that's when you actually get somewhere and get something accomplished. That's what we need to be doing and what we need to be thinking about. The soil health thing on the agriculture side, I know I harp on that a lot, but I still say if we can do things to harden our system in ways that increase organic matter, improve the health of our soil, it's not a silver bullet that kills every monster, but it's a big rock that kills a whole lot of birds, I'll guarantee you, and it's something that we need to be looking at. We need to be doing things also in the urban areas, like was mentioned, to be better stewards of what we have, making sure that we're ready for the change. Because, yeah, I mean, if you quit putting all – I mean, if no CO2 went into the atmosphere from anything other than just normal biological practices tomorrow, we still got a lot that's got to be dealt with. Goes back to photosynthesis. I think that's something we need to be restoring that in organic matter, but we need to be ready because there's things that are going to happen no matter what happens tomorrow. There's some switches that have flipped, and we're just going to have to deal with it.
All right. Just name and tell me where you're from.
Joel Olson. I live in Moore. We're on the Lake Thunderbird watershed, and I kind of hear what you're saying about capturing the runoff. Before I forget it, I heard the other day that goats like to eat that red cedar. There was a bill up in the legislature. It's called the Freedom to Farm Act, or something like that. And as I understand it, it means that the state could not interfere with a farmer doing whatever he thought was best with his property, which means that we cannot act anything to protect the aquifers, cannot force anything that'll help with water conservation. We can't tell him he's got to clear out the red cedar. We can't tell him that he has to stop plowing or minimize the plowing. So where's that bill at? Did you support it?
The organization I worked for took no position on the bill. So now I'm going to put my politician hat on. OACD has no position in favor or against that legislation. We have not taken a stand one way or another. That being said, I can say this from an agriculture standpoint. Now I'm going to put my farmer hat on. And this is something that I've told a lot of groups. As an agriculture producer, you can lead me anywhere, but I'll be damned if I'll be pushed. I mentioned in the 1930s what happened with what the Roosevelt administration did to address the Dust Bowl. And it was a hot topic. If you go back and read the history of the discussions that happened during the Dust Bowl, there were people that said we made a mistake with the Homestead Act. Southern Plains shouldn't have been settled. We ought to turn it back into grass and just forget about it. The decision was made, no, that we're not going to do that. We're going to come out with incentive-based programs, work to keep the land productive, find locally-led solutions to solve the problem. I would contend that yeah, there was some dust blowing on Sunday, but again, you compare it to what we saw even in the 50s, let alone the 1930s, and it's nowhere near that bad. That works. Now, that being said, regulations have their place. I think the thing that we need to focus on, though, is making sure that we've got the tools out there and that people understand what's in their best interest. Because when you're talking about a lot of these challenges on weather extremes, it's in your best interest to try to address it. As far as goats eating eastern red cedar, it depends on what the nanny eats. If a nanny eats a red cedar, a kid will eat the red cedar. Got a little experience with that one, too. And if anybody tells you that you can hold a goat in with anything other than woven wire, they're lying to you. I got some experience with that as well, too. But that's what...
And as a reporter, we have looked into this Freedom to Farm bill, and it's kind of ambiguously worded. We might have a story if this bill ends up going anywhere. But I will say, having talked to the Water Resources Board, they are a little worried about the ambiguous language in that it might preclude the Water Resources Board or some of the water policy planners from coming up with rules, regulations, or doing things that might address water, but it's not clear if that bill is going to go anywhere yet. So
there's no in November on the constitutional amendment.
There's no saying at the Capitol, I got friends who are for it and friends who are against it, and by damn, I'm with my friends. Now, that's all.
Yeah. Question.
Yeah. Eric Qualley, Oklahoma City. I was just wondering if you'd care to comment on the health of the freshwater aquifer in the western half of the state.
The Ogallala, right?
Ogallala.
How's that thing doing?
It continues to decline mostly. And I think what's kind of shocking to me is that Oklahoma only has 2% of the Ogallala. So, you know, what seems to us is a large concern, I mean, if you look at nationally or regionally, as it is a regional aquifer, it's, you know, our part's really very small. And if you go to Nebraska, they really have ramped up their exploitation of that resource recently. In fact, the way I understand it, Nebraska now is the number one irrigated state in the nation, have passed California, and a lot of that is Ogallala. I asked a colleague of mine in Kansas a few years ago, you know, what are you thinking about in Kansas? Of course, Kansas, I don't know what the percentage they have, but it's quite a bit larger than us, and they're more reliant upon them in terms of their agricultural sector. It's a mining operation, so you mine it until it's gone. And that's in Kansas.
I believe the law in Oklahoma is set up such that it's there and it's in the laws for oil and gas extraction and regular mining to be used as a resource by which to draw down.
Now, one thing I will say, you give credit where credit's due. There has been, as irrigation has changed, they're doing a lot better job of using it. That there's been some studies out. If you look at from the time they first tapped the well to about, say, 20 years ago, it was just, I mean, the amount of the drop in the Ogallala was horrible. It still continues to decline. Now, whether you're being as efficient as you can with it or not, I think the bottom line is it's a finite resource. That's not going to reach. Now, we've got other aquifers that recharge. That one, that's left over from the last ice age. That's a concern. Now, some places, Texas County, it's pretty deep. And if they're careful and they use the best irrigation technology, get up over 90% of their efficiency, they got a long time that they can utilize it. Cimarron County, not so much. And I think that's a challenge. And whether it's going to be gone tomorrow or gone 1,000 years from now, it's a finite resource. And you've got to be careful and understand that and recognize that you just can't go willy-nilly with it. And also have a plan for what you're going to do when that's gone. Because as a cow-calf producer and as a stocker producer, I don't think we've talked enough that the reason why those feedlots are there is because the corn's there. And the reason why the corn's there is because the irrigation's there. So what happens in western Oklahoma on wheat pasture if you don't have those feedlots? And what happens in eastern Oklahoma and central Oklahoma with cow-calf operators if you don't have wheat pasture? You know, all of a sudden you see that there's an economic hit there that I think long-term we need to look at a little bit more, and we haven't talked that much about. But going back to my earlier statement about the irrigators, the guys up there are doing a better job of using it, and they've done it. They've done yeoman's work, but it is a finite resource, and one day it will be gone.
Got another point on that, just real quickly. Not every part's, as Clay said, not every part of that aquifer, even in we're talking about the Ogallala, even in Oklahoma, is being drawn down at the same rate. So different parts of it have more water, shallower water, and they're drawn down at different rates.
I'm Dr. Kathy Rand, and I'm a co-leader of Citizens Climate Lobby in Norman. And talking about finite resources, our atmosphere is a finite resource as well. And so far, you've been focusing on adapting to drought and extreme weather. And some of us are focusing at the other side of trying to prevent further damage that is causing climate change by carbon dioxide emissions. For instance, putting a fee on carbon emissions with the fee returned to households evenly. And I'm wondering if you'd like to talk about efforts to actually reduce carbon emissions.
Heard of anything? Something. I could, because you certainly as a reporter at the Capitol, I haven't heard anything about a fee, and I'm not sure how well that would be received up there, but maybe you guys know more. Have you heard anything about more proactive?
You know, I think one of the things as far as from, you know, one of the things that we've actually got in Oklahoma right now, if anybody's interested, we actually do have a program where if you want to offset your footprint right now, There is a program in the state of Oklahoma where you can partner with folks that are doing things to sequester carbon dioxide on their land, which has other environmental benefits. In fact, Oklahoma, a lot of folks don't realize this, Oklahoma has right now, California is working on one right now as part of their emissions reduction system, but Oklahoma has the only functioning terrestrial carbon sequestration program in the country, and it's kind of a secret. We have a verification system that there was a study done, Sarah, what's it been, about two or three years ago, that they actually looked at the carbon offset programs in the United States, not just in Oklahoma, in the United States, you know, Oklahoma. They looked at California. They looked at some of the stuff that's done in New England. They looked at Canada. They looked at China. They looked at Europe. Looked everywhere around the globe. And they said the best and most extensive and most developed program, believe it or not, was in Oklahoma. There's about 50,000 acres right now signed up under the program. If anybody's interested, you can go online. There actually is a program where you can offset your footprint. About $40 worth of work on the land can offset a car. If I remember right, is about what the switch is. So it's a way you can do it, and it also has water quality benefits, wildlife benefits, and all this other stuff too. You know, I think from an Oklahoma perspective, I think things that can get people working together in a partnership way is probably going to be our best bet. You know, things that we can do to address these problems constructively, because at the end of the day, I mean, I think that's the challenge, is that some switches have been flipped. We've got to try to adapt it. We've also got to be looking ahead to the future, and I think how we do that is the matter of the debate and how we get to that point.
Like, what is that website?
Ecopassok.org.
Nice. All right, last question comes from up here.
Thank you. My name is Russell Dowdy. I'm a fourth-generation landowner and forester in southeastern Oklahoma, outside of Tallahena. I also have degrees in economics and sustainable natural resources, and I'm working on my thesis at Oregon State University right now, Department of Forestry, so you can probably guess where this question's going. I'd like to kind of turn it to our forests for a second, because we've talked about rangelands and pasture lands and urban landscapes, but In my research, I quickly discovered that forests have a large role in the water cycle and even the nitrogen cycle, and these two cycles are often left out, especially in something like a carbon program. And in my research, a couple of numbers really stuck out to me, and it's that we only have about half of our forests left in Oklahoma from pre-settlement. That's a number that reflects the state of the entire earth. We only have about half of our forests left. And since forests are such a source of transpiration, which is water from the landscape into the atmosphere, my concern is that by annihilating our forests, we've really put our foot into the water cycle, which is important for reflecting solar rays from the earth. It's important for lightning, which is one of only two sources of fixed nitrogen. So you can quickly discover a self-reinforcing cycle there with forests and our waters. So my question is what are we doing here in the state with our forests, and how are we looking at forests and what role they might play in making Oklahoma more resilient to climate change?
Thank you. Good question. We spent a lot of time talking about Western Oklahoma and Northwestern Oklahoma, but let's talk about the forest.
Actually, forestry on that program talked about on EcoPass, it actually does do it partnered with the forestry department over at the Department of Agriculture. That does qualify on that. But you're right. I mean, how we manage our landscapes, whether you're talking about forestry, whether you're talking about grasslands, we're talking about water, however you manage that ecosystem, you're absolutely right, because that's one of the things we've done, even with forestry, with how we've managed our forest lands. Talking about Aldo Leopold and some of the things that we've knocked the water cycle out of whack. We've knocked the carbon and nitrogen cycle out of whack. We've done some things that, again, nobody was being evil. Nobody, but the thing is, we've done some things. Nature is like a tapestry, you know, and that's what, you know, I Northwest Oklahoma work on prairie chicken stuff a lot too. And they say, well, why do you care about the prairie chicken? Why do you care about, you know, the river shiner, whatever it might be? Well, you know, I can understand, you know, farm boy, I kind of understand where you're coming from. But the flip side of that is, it's like a big tapestry. And if you pull a thread out down here, something's going to come loose up. It's like I told somebody, nature's a machine. Nature evolved. It all works together as a system. And that goes back to what I was saying about the no-till, about biomimicry. How do we get back to that point where we learn the lessons that what nature, what God made and how it evolved and set itself up, there's lessons to be learned there. And how do we understand that we learn those lessons and mimic what nature's given us? It's a machine. It's an engine. You can go out to your car, any car out here in the parking lot, you can pop the hood on it, you can start jerking stuff out from underneath it, and you're probably going to be able to hop behind the wheel and it'll still run. Might not run best in the world, but it'll run. But if you keep pulling pieces out of there, eventually you're going to get to something that that engine's not going to start. And that's what the concern is how do we manage that right? And whether you're talking about proper forest management, where you're talking about proper grassland management, where you're talking about good soil health on cropland, whatever it is. How do you do that? Because you're right. I mean, if we knock these things out of whack, eastern red cedar, we take fire away from the prairie, red cedar breaks out of its bounds. It's not we call it invasive species. It ain't an invasive species. It just broke out of its bounds. But look what it does. You know, same way, you know, you just start ticking it off. You've changed the balance, and for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Those are the things we got to learn, because we still need to use our resources. We do have 9 billion people we're going to have to feed by mid-century. We've got to recognize that we've got to use our resources. We've got to provide the food and fiber, the natural resources to do that. But how you do that in a way without – how do you do it in a way that's sustainable? That's the bottom line. How do you do that? We can do it. And I think I got a lot of hope. I mean, there's a lot of things that frustrate me. There's a lot of things that I get depressed about. But I do think if we look at some of the lessons that we've got out there, there's ways, you know, and again, I keep to sound like a broken record on the soil health thing, but there's things like this where we can come together, where modern agriculture, modern forestry, the environmental community can come together, and we can solve these problems and can move forward on the discussion. It doesn't have to be at loggerheads all the time. And that's what excites me, is we've got some of these tools out there. If we can just figure out how to get them implemented and have that discussion.
We can all come together. I think that's a good way to kind of close this out.
Michael Cross, he had a quick...
Oh, did he?
Quick correction here before we wrap.
What was his correction, Michael?
EcoPassOK.com.
Not .org.
EcoPassOK.com. Yeah, it's a site to go to find out.
Yeah, I tweeted it out, so follow me. Michael C.
Thank you, everybody, for coming out. I think let's give our panelists a big hand here.